Money Radio. Thank you for joining us. Pleasure now to welcome Bobby Monks. He is an entrepreneur, and he has founded, led, or grown some 19 businesses in financial services, real estate, media, and technology. He was chairman of Spinnaker Trust, managing over $1 billion in assets. He was chairman of Institutional Shareholder Services, ISS, a provider of corporate governance and proxy services, and founder and director of Atlantic Bank. He's also an author. New book, Uninvested, How Wall Street Hijacks Your Money and How to Fight Back, Uninvested, by Bobby Monks. Thank you so much for joining us today, Bobby.
Thank you for having me.
You say uninvested, and yet we have seen over the past 20 years or so, a fair portion of America has become invested in the stock market, the democratization of finance. Not quite half, but a fair number of people are, particularly when you compare it like to the 1950s or so. Back in the 50s, almost nobody was investing in the stock market. Today, a good number of people do. So why do you call it uninvested?
Well, I think there are two reasons for that. One is that the average investor, who we believe is being systematically taken advantage of by the financial services industry, has outsourced their money management. And because of that, and because of the complexity of the system, they are really not relating to the system in a way that allows them to really be invested in what stocks they own and what the consequences are of outsourcing. And the second reason has to do with the fact that many money managers, almost 90% of them, don't have to put the interest of the client first. So they are not invested in the interest of the client.
Okay, that makes sense. And for that matter, you look at most investors, they're just overwhelmed by the financial system. They turn it over to money managers, but, you know, how did we get to that point? At one point, you'd buy a stock. You'd buy shares maybe in the company that you worked with or
That's
a company that you knew about. Typically, it was a company that worked in your state or your city. You knew somebody who worked there. Maybe you had one or two, maybe five holdings. How did we get to the point to where we have such diversity that we don't even know what we own?
Well, I think that was really generated by the migration from the defined benefit plan to the defined contribution plan. And if you remember, Sinclair, for many, many years, someone would go to work for a large corporation, and they would get essentially a pension from their defined benefit plan that paid out during their retirement. And that was really part of the American dream. Eventually, those defined benefit plans became too expensive for the corporations, and they migrated towards defined contribution plans, which is the 401k and the IRA. And those plans opened up a whole floodgate of different products that were sold in order to service the retirement needs of the next generation.
You say defined benefit plans became too expensive. They really didn't become too expensive. They were just so poorly managed. Isn't that really what the problem was?
Well, I think you're correct, Sinclair. I think that's right. Certainly, a lot of that depends on who you ask. Certainly, if you ask the management of the corporations, they'll say they're too expensive. But the real problem was that many of them were underfunded because when you funded them, you had to expense them, and therefore your income was less, and therefore your stock price was less.
So basically, they were cooking the books to underfund the pensions. Pensions didn't work out. So then they turn around and say, well, come up with your own pension in the form of a IRA or 401k, a defined contribution plan.
That is exactly correct. And if you look at, you know, one of the major problems with a 401k is that there are layers of fees. So you pay the administrative fee, you pay the manager, who is then, you know, invests in a mutual fund, and then the mutual fund trades, and if you stack all those fees up, they can be over 2%. And that's a lot of money to be taking out of someone's retirement account, especially over a long period of time.
You talked with Jack Bogle over the course of this book, and there's quite a bit of insight from Bogle. Bogle, of course, we know from Vanguard, and just one of the legendary figures when it comes to investing, one of the giants in the industry. That 2% may not sound like much, but over time, with the power of compounding, the difference is huge.
That's correct. For example, if you take 1% on a $25,000 investment over 30 years with an average yield of 7%, the cost is $65,000. So it's a very, very big number. And you mentioned Jack Bogle. I give Jack Bogle a tremendous amount of credit for pushing down the fees that are paid by investors in index funds. But we also believe that index funds don't go far enough. And part of the reason for that is that not all index funds are made the same. Some are cheap, some aren't. The trading costs in index funds, while lower than mutual funds and ETFs, can be relatively high. And I think the other reason is that it's at the end of the day, there's so many index funds now. How do you pick your index fund? Well, you have to hire someone to inform you about what the index funds are so that you can then make a legitimate choice. So there are real fees associated with index funds.
And at a certain point, how many stocks do we actually need in a portfolio? You own a couple of index funds, you may actually be an owner of a couple of thousand stocks.
That's exactly correct. And there's also a second round of issues with index funds, and that's the corporate governance behavior. And unfortunately, in terms of corporate governance, most index funds just check the box for management when they're voting their proxies. So they're not necessarily representing the folks that are invested in their funds.
At one point in the book, you said that some 75% of all equities are held by intermediaries. Explain that for us.
Well, an intermediary would be a pension fund, a mutual fund, index fund, a hedge fund, a private equity firm, anything that's not an individual stock, you know, that an individual doesn't own the stock themselves.
So when I said that if I own a couple of index funds, I may own a couple of thousand stocks, I really don't own those stocks.
That's correct. You own the overarching index fund, shares of the overarching index fund.
Once upon a time, there was an idea that if you owned a share of stock, you could vote that share.
That's correct. And one of the things that I think is happening now, which is very positive, is because technology has improved, is that the ability for the individual to be able to vote their proxy is greatly enhanced now. And so that I think that's going to have a sea change.
Do you know anybody who owns an index index mutual fund? Just a typical investor out there, they buy the S&P 500 or some other index fund, it doesn't matter. Do you know anybody who actually votes on any of the shares within that index fund?
Well, you really can't vote. The folks who vote are really the managers of whatever fund you're in.
Do you have any idea how they vote?
Yes, but for the vast majority of time, especially in index funds, they vote for management. Sometimes they vote differently, but it's quite rare.
They're not necessarily voting for the clients who buy into the fund. They're voting for management of the company.
That's exactly correct, Sinclair. It's exactly right. And what's interesting is I think with one of the things that I learned when I was chairman of ISS, because we made recommendations to institutional investors on how they vote their proxy, and then we would electronically vote their proxy, is that we collated a certain amount of power so that if a senior executive or a CEO wanted to have their compensation plan passed, they would often come to our office, and we provided a lot of the time the counterbalancing force. We could say no, and it meant something.
I want to get into that, but I do want a quick follow-up first. As
sure.
I said, you'd said 75% of equities held by intermediaries. I would say that's incorrect. I would say that it's probably closer to 99%, because even if you hold individual shares through a brokerage firm, those shares are hypothecated.
Right, you're not the beneficiary owner of it. Right, right. I think you are correct. I stand corrected.
I mean, you bring up a valid point about 75% held by intermediaries, but really it's even less than that when we consider the structure of brokerages.
Right, when you consider who the beneficial owner really is, right.
So, yes, back to you see what I'm saying? We don't really own anything in this country, do we?
Yeah, I think you've got a very good point, and I agree with you wholeheartedly about that.
So basically, all the equities in this country are not owned by individual investors out there. We may think we do, but we don't really.
I would agree with that, and I think what I am advocating is that individual investors get engaged with the process, and that. In my book, you can understand what the system is like and where the mistakes are, and then we give a list of questions that a individual investor can ask their money manager so that they can get a better understanding of what the deal is they actually have.
Now, you are chairman of Institutional Shareholder Services, ISS.
Correct.
And a lot of people may not know what ISS is, but ISS kind of came to some people's attention probably back in May at the J.P. Morgan shareholders meeting.
Right,
where part of the issue at the shareholders meeting was Jamie Dimon's compensation package.
Right.
And ISS, serving as proxy, voted against that pay package, correct?
Right, for good reason.
What was the good reason?
Well, it's too much.
But he had made that much before, and you hadn't opposed.
Well, I sold ISS 5 years ago.
You're right. Okay, so it wasn't used specifically.
I'm not familiar with what their reasoning is now in terms of it, but so I'm somewhat speculating.
Well, I can tell you what I've learned from it is that the compensation package was not tied to performance. There were no performance criteria there, which, quite frankly, makes a lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure you heard what Jamie Dimon had to say. He says, God knows how any of you can place your vote based on ISS. If you do that, you're just irresponsible. I'm sorry. You probably aren't a very good investor either. And you do. Believe me, I know some of you are here. Do it because you're lazy.
Huh.
Can you, first of all, I thought Jamie Dimon... It was basically calling shareholders lazy and stupid investors because they invested in J.P. Morgan. Am I wrong about that?
Well, that sounds like that is correct. And of course, I would disagree with his assertion. I think that ISS, the way it works, is that ISS often works with the institution to develop a policy that is along the lines of which the institution feels about given proxy issues. And ISS will make recommendations about different governance issues, but that usually comes from a process where they have essentially been incorporated the knowledge and advice of many of the stakeholders.
So when we talk about the idea of one share, one vote, you can vote that share. What's really happening now is that we have a few individual shareholders, and for the small shareholders, they're completely glossed over. Then you've got some bigger shareholders. Then you've got a few people standing up in the role of proxy because people just can't go around every shareholder meeting. And then you've got the institutional owners, and the institutional owners are sitting there saying, who cares about fraud? Who cares about performance as long as you make us money?
That's correct. Right. And because that's at the end of the day, I mean, there are institutional owners that have been very serious about corporate governance. I mean, certainly CalPERS has, as well as some of the other public pension funds. So that's, not entirely correct, but there's certainly elements of what you say that is correct.
I'm not that far off base. Hang on. We're talking with Bobby Monks, the new book, Uninvested. We'll look at solutions as this conversation continues. Money Radio. Thank you for joining us. Our guest today is Bobby Monks. He is the author of a new book, Uninvested: How Wall Street Hijacks Your Money and How to Fight Back. Well, Bobby, so far we've talked about how Wall Street hijacks your money. You really don't control your money. It's controlled by intermediaries. They're not necessarily looking out for your best interest. The whole process is set up to where they skim a certain amount, and that's how they make their money. What's the other part of this? How to fight back? How do we fight back? What's the solution?
Well, I think the solution really is for investors to wake up and become engaged in the process of how they relate to their money manager. And what we suggest in the book is a series of questions that you would ask your money manager, such as, do you have to put your interest ahead of mine? What are my total fees?
In other words, are they a fiduciary?
That's correct.
How many of them are?
Well, there are estimates that 90% aren't and about 10% are. The what's called registered investment advisors, RIAs, have a fiduciary responsibility that's higher than the ones for brokers, for example. And as you probably know, there's a DOL ruling that's attempting to change that.
Do you think it'll fly?
You know, Sinclair, it's hard to know because the financial service industry has so much power in terms of lobbying and in terms of contributions to politicians that it's hard to know. I certainly hope it does because, especially in the area of 401ks, it's really important that the money manager have to put the interest of the client first. In the 401k, as you probably know, there's a custom of something called revenue sharing. And revenue sharing is something that's very detrimental to shareholders. To investors.
Okay. What else can we do?
Well, I think what you do is you can engage with your money manager, and if you feel uncomfortable, you can go to our website, and we will give us your money manager's email address, and we'll send an email to him for you. But once you've done that, it's really important that you hear the answers that they give you, and if you don't like those answers, then you pick up shop and go next door and ask the next person, because the industry is changing now. Fees are coming down. There are many ways in which you can invest in the market, and we believe it's really important for the average investor to ask those questions and then feel comfortable with the folks that are managing their money. It's sort of like if you were to go buy a car, you'd go out and look at a bunch of different cars. You wouldn't just default to the first person. We are strongly advocating that you go out, shop around, ask the questions that we suggest, make sure you understand them, and then pick the person or the manner to invest that feels most comfortable to you.
And then I would say also, don't be afraid to
negotiate.
To negotiate, but don't be afraid to just do some of this yourself. You may not need a money manager. You may not need a mutual fund. You can invest directly into stocks. And there's also something that's changing now is more and more people, even some non-accredited investors, are going to be able to have the opportunity to do direct private equity investment.
That is correct through BlackRock, right? I mean, what your point is a very good one, Sinclair, because at the end of the day, the financial services industry has spooked people around from investing themselves. But you're always making a choice. You're making a choice to invest in a stock. You're making a choice to invest in a mutual fund. You're making a choice for a broker or for a money manager. And the question is, which is the one that's more likely to make you money in the long run?
And you can't just be asleep at the wheel.
Is that it costs more? That it's harder to make money the more fees you pay.
And you can't be asleep at the wheel. You have think about it this way: if you had $100,000 or $500 or $1 million or whatever you've got invested in a small business, you'd be down at the shop every day.
That's correct.
Yeah, wake up. Uninvested, a good book. It really got me going. Uninvested by Bobby Monks. Uninvested: How Wall Street Hijacks Your Money and How to Fight Back. Uninvested by Bobby Monks. Bobby, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Sinclair. Have a good weekend.